What does the phrase "know thyself" really mean? What exactly is the self? How can we make it work better? This week, Eric talks about his own ideas about the self on 9 Questions with Eric Oliver. Hi, my name's Andrea Morales, and I am the executive producer of 9 Questions with Eric Oliver. You may have heard me chat with Eric at the top of most of our episodes, but you know, my main role is mostly to make fun of him behind the scenes. If you're new to the podcast, you may not know that 9 Questions was developed from a course that Eric teaches at the University of Chicago. I believe that he's been teaching this course for the better part of the last 20 or so years, you know, since literally the last century. I've also heard that it's a campus favorite. And upon watching his lectures, which you can find on the 9 Questions YouTube page, I understand why. Eric breaks down ideas in an easily digestible and comprehensive way while being engaging and entertaining at the same time. He invites you to think about who you are and what you are. So, in this special episode of 9 Questions, I invite you to sit down, maybe grab a cup of tea or a glass of wine, and enjoy a lecture from Eric.
Hi, everybody. This is Eric Oliver. We are in a little bit of a gap in terms of our guest scheduling. We have a bunch of great guests that are about to come on the show. But in the meantime, we thought we'd put up a little content here. And a lot of these podcasts will have the host come on and do kind of a solo act. And I'm going to do that now. Right now, I'm teaching my class here at the University of Chicago on how to know yourself. And this has been a theme, of course, of this entire podcast. And I thought it might be worthwhile at this point for me to share a little information about what I've been telling my students and what I've been learning from all the guests that we've had here and kind of my own explorations around this. So I thought I would just talk a little bit about how I think of the self and how I'm thinking about this in the book that I'm writing and what are some good ways that we might go about knowing ourselves. And I want to start with a quote here, and it's 2 words: know thyself. Now, these 2 words loom over us with a foreboding authority. Legend has it they were inscribed on the ancient temple to Apollo in Delphi, Greece, the same temple where the oracles would give their visions of the future. And oftentimes this quote is often attributed to Socrates as well. And the idea here seems to crystallize or encapsulate all the wisdom of ancient Greece. If we want to have authentic, liberated, fully meaningful lives, then we'll need to get to the root of our essence. We'll need to know ourselves. And this is what I've long believed. I think I first got this idea from Mrs. Malone, my senior English teacher. She wrote "Know Thyself" on the blackboard. And I think she was trying to leverage our teenage narcissism into an appetite for literature. And she said, okay, if we read these great books, we'll get to know ourselves better and we'll be empowered. And on me, it worked. And I really took that piece of advice seriously. And then when I went to college, I got a lot of the same kind of wisdom that if I wanted to really find true happiness, I had to get to the root of my own experience. Otherwise, I'd just be living according to somebody else's program. And then I spent a lot of my 20s and 30s pursuing this. I was trying to find this self. And I did a lot of things like Buddhism. I read into philosophy and existentialism, did a lot of outdoor activities. I started doing yoga. I started going on these long meditation retreats. And all of it was kind of groping around trying to find this elusive self. And it was only later that I realized that there was a little bit of a problem with my quest. It turns out the Greeks didn't have a word for self, at least in the same way that we have a word for self in this kind of modern self-helpy, new agey kind of self. When they were saying "know thyself," and insofar as that these 2 words were inscribed on the temple at Delphi, they probably meant something more like "know your place." This was a sacred space, after all, and that was probably more of an admonition to put on your best tunic, put down your wine, stop fooling around. You know, take this seriously. And here's the interesting piece of information. If you go and you look across human history across time, you'll find that "know thy place" is probably the best advice you can live by. Because Up until quite recently, most people lived in small communities that were tightly bound by tradition and by custom, and people didn't really have a lot of freedom. So they didn't really ask themselves, you know, is my marriage great, because their marriage was arranged for them. They didn't ask, you know, what is my dream job, because they just were doing whatever they could to survive. They didn't really ask themselves, is this making me happy, because they didn't have a lot of liberty in their circumstance. Instead, what they had were a bunch of stories and myths and a community that held them very, very tight and monitored their every action. And this is how it has been for most people across most of time, until a couple of hundred years ago, a few hundred years ago. And it was with the birth of the Enlightenment, when Copernicus established that the Earth was not the center of the universe, when Descartes started ruminating on his own consciousness, just using his reason. Later, when Darwin said that we're just merely the outcome of a random and chance circumstance of evolution, what all of this served to do was really undermine the myths and traditions that had been holding Western Europeans together for hundreds and hundreds of years prior to that time. And in dislodging those myths and in dislodging those customs, on the one hand, it kind of set us free. With the advent of industrialization and market capitalism and this sort of rise of the individual as the central focus of religion and Protestantism and politics, with the rise of democracy, in the economy, with the rise of capitalism, we came to have this very individualized, centered view of the world. And the adage, know thy place, really got switched around to the kind of modern meaning that we know today of know thyself. But then what I realized here was that my efforts to kind of know myself wasn't really trying to find some wisdom that was out there in some ancient tradition as much as it was trying to find a way out of this modern predicament. But that then raised the ongoing question, which was, well, what path should I follow? It wasn't very clear to me. And then I was sort of struggling with this. And about 20 years ago, I came here to the University of Chicago and I started teaching a class. At the time, I didn't even know it was a class about knowing the self. I just was interested in psychoanalytic theory and Buddhism and neuroscience. And I thought, oh, okay, maybe I'll just put these together and see what happens. And it turns out that that was a successful class. And I realized, oh, this is what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to figure out what's the root essence here of this existence. And over the past two decades, as I've been teaching this class, this view has evolved. I've had the great fortune of having these really amazing, brilliant students to interact with, and a university here that supports me just doing this kind of wide-ranging exploration. And from that is the new book that I'm writing, and it's also the genesis of this podcast. And it's really about how we might know the self in a contemporary setting. And, you know, when we think about modern versions of the self, if you go online, for example, and you try to find out what is the self, you're not likely to find a lot of good responses out there. For example, when I wanted to find out what the self is, of course, I went to the foundation of all great knowledge and wisdom today. I went to Wikipedia. And if you type in self on Wikipedia, you'll get an entry that sounds something like this. It says, "The self is an individual person as the object of its own reflective consciousness. Since the self is a reference by a subject to the same subject, this reference is necessarily subjective. The sense of having a self or selfhood should, however, not be confused with subjectivity itself." Okay, that's the opening lines on self in Wikipedia, and kind of obtuse and philosophical and not necessarily very helpful. If you go other places on the web, you're likely to see things like, you know, the self is a person's essential being, or an individual's typical character, or your sense of who you are deep down, or even a person's experience as a unitary being. And those seem kind of fine, except they also have a lot of problems to them. Because think about, okay, a person's essential being, where is there any part of us that's non-essential to our being? Maybe there is. Or an individual's typical character. Well, what are the factors that define character? Or your sense of who you are deep down? Well, what about the sense of who you are up high? Or how? Why is deep down in some ways more authentic than up high? I mean, so you can see there's a lot of problematic aspects here. And then, you know, if you can go further on the web, you can find these things like in the kind of the more pro-business sections of self-help, where they talk about, if you want to know yourself, you got to identify these core questions, like what are you passionate about? What are you good at? And where is their market demand? And imagine those as sort of being the source of a Venn diagram. And at the center of those three things, well, that's where you'll find yourself. And then, of course, there's this whole genre of books out there called self-help. And now the thing with self-help books, some self-help books are great. They can be actually very useful for us in helping us, you know, think about things like how we might manage our habits or time or rejigger our just negative thought patterns. And some of those books are not that useful. But, you know, all of these books, despite whatever use they have, all have one common problem. They actually never define the self that they're actually trying to help. And so what I'm going to be trying to do here in this podcast is I'm going to describe what the self is. And based on kind of my trying to synthesize things like psychoanalytic theory with Buddhism, with ancient philosophy, which with neuroscience. And by blending all of these traditions together, I'm going to try to offer a vision about what the self is. And I'm going to start with a simple definition. And it's going to sound kind of wooey at first, but just bear with me because it's actually based in science, strangely enough. But just listen. So when I think of what the self is, the self are all the processes that negotiate between our internal life force and our external reality. So once again, the self is all those processes that negotiate between our internal life force and our external reality. And the reason we want to know ourselves is it's important to know what those processes are. But more importantly, it's important to know how and why they malfunction and what we can do to make them work better. Now, there are a couple of important things to note about this definition. First off, when I'm talking about these self processes, they're processes, they're not things. Normally, when we talk about the self, we're talking about a static thing. We want to reference it as a thing. And this is how we normally think about the world. We want to make the world legible and fixed so we can understand it. And so we tend to think of reality relative to things. But the reality of you is actually that you're a process, or that you're actually a series of processes. You're never the same from moment to moment. There's always going to be some part of you, either at the physical level or at the psychological level, or even the spiritual level, if you want to go that far, that is in change, in constant flux. And the way I think about the self is it's not just even one process, it's a set of processes. And it's a set of processes that start kind of at a core and then elaborate outward. And this outward elaboration actually traces our evolution as life forms. And so one way to think about it is think of these self processes as like a set of rushing nesting dolls. And within each doll you pull out, there's a sort of similar but somewhat different version of the doll. And you can keep going inward and inward and inward. And this is really what our self processes are like. And at the very core, the smallest little Russian nesting doll, the very core of our self processes is what I call the cellular self. Now, this is the part of us that traces back all the way back to the beginning of life. And it starts with our earliest bacterial ancestor. This little creature called LUCA, which stands for Last Universal Common Ancestor. And this creature, they estimate, lived about 3.7 billion years ago. And LUCA was doing one thing. LUCA was basically an energy system. And LUCA was an energy system resisting entropy. And the important thing to think about that is when we think about this, this actually goes to the life force. So when I use the term life force, what I'm describing are basically the processes and the impetus of this kind of sustained metabolic chemical reaction that's occurring within us to keep itself going. So imagine that, you know, your life is really like a fire. And as long as you are alive, this fire is burning. And really what your life is keeping this kind of internal energy system, this fire within you, going. As soon as the fire goes out, you die. And, you know, you want to reproduce yourself by making more little fires and let your little fires run and grow up and become their own fires. And that's basically what life is. It's just a sustained chemical metabolic fire, so to speak, that's going on. And it started off in these little microscopic little cells that start sustaining these chemical reactions over time. And they become encapsulated in a membrane and they started having a DNA structure. But all of these things were basically existing to do one key thing, which was resist entropy. And entropy is the great degrading force of the universe. To say this kind of quickly and summarize it, what we are seeing in our universe is a degrading in its energy potential. If you go back to the very beginning of the universe, you know, nearly 14 billion years ago, energy was at its lowest state of entropy or its highest potential for something to happen. And the, you know, timeless moment, which is kind of a funny thing to say, but that's what it was. It was because it was a period without time as we know it. And before time as we know it or space as we know it existed, the universe was in its highest energy potential. It was its greatest potential for something to happen. In fact, it was the potential for an entire universe. And suddenly something, for whatever reason, sparked this, and this was the Big Bang. And what the Big Bang was basically a differentiation of this energy potential into a lot of different kinds of energies that we see now. And if, according to science, if you look at the history of the Big Bang, what you're basically seeing is this unfolding of these different energy types. And as these different energy types are unfolding, matter is beginning to percolate up. And at some point in this creation of space and the creation of all of these different kinds of energy, things get somewhat stabilized and we get the universe that we see around us today. But what's really happening is that this is a kind of degradation of energy potential. Every time we do something, when we transfer energy from one form to another, we're almost inevitably degrading its potential. So imagine like a bunch of logs that are stacked in a fire. You know, once you burn those logs and you extract the energy from them to make a fire, you're never going to make a set of logs again from the heat and the light and the smoke that came from it. That's basically what entropy is. It's just this, when you have energy in one form and degrading it down to another form. Now, the problem is that entropy is persistent across the universe. When you look up and you see the nighttime sky, what you are seeing is entropy increasing. It's the degradation of the energy potential of the universe. And that is just relentless. And basically, several billion years from now, our universe is going to degrade in its energy potential down to its highest state of entropy or its lowest potential for something to happen. And it's going to be kind of a largely cold, dark, motionless place. That's where entropy is taking us. And that's kind of the destiny of the universe. And that's the universal law. That's just what's happening. And when you see stars, when you see rocks, when you see anything else around you, everything is degrading over time. It's succumbing to entropy. And there's one thing that's not succumbing to entropy, and that's life. We can actually define life as that which is pushing back against entropy's relentless toll. It's an energy system that is drawing in energy around it to sustain itself, to keep itself high in its potential, to keep itself capable of doing more and more things. And that's what living things do. And it started with life on our planet, and it was started in a microbial way. And it started for billions of years. It was just these microbes, these, you know, minuscule, tiny little encapsulated energy systems that were just pulling in energy from around them, probably first from ocean vents and the Earth's thermal heat, and then later from solar energy, and generating this kind of ongoing, sustained chemical reaction in the face and pushing back against entropy. And that's what our cellular self is at its core. We are at our deepest, deepest level, an energy system that is resisting entropy. And that's what life did for billions of years, up until about 600 million years ago. And then we get sort of the next layer of self that begins to occur. And this happens with the Metazoan period. This is basically when multicellular life began to grow. And in our case, it was multicellular animal life. And this was a very important change in the history of life, and really important for us, obviously, because suddenly you had, rather than individual cells that were resisting entropy in solitude, They started coming together and jointly resisting entropy. Now, when they started coming together, though, they had to figure out ways of coordinating their actions. And this is when we begin to see the development and growth of animals. It's with this first movement toward multicellular life forms. And then when these multicellular life forms started coming together, they started specializing. And this is what's really important. When they started working together, they started becoming what we might say intradependent, because now there were certain cells that became just muscle cells, and there were certain cells that might become receptor cells, like nerve cells. And that meant that they were fundamentally interdependent on each other to survive. And in order to do that, then they also started having other principles that were keeping them going. So they had things like coherence. They had to find a way of unifying their action together. We see in evolutionary history, they started situating themselves in time. They started having, as they became enclosed, they started having respiration and circulation. So they started having breath and heartbeats. They started storing memories. And this goes way back in our evolutionary lineage, like, you know, to our great worm ancestors. And most importantly here, I think, for when we think about our animal self, they started absorbing a lot more information from their environments and more information about themselves. And they had to figure out a way to store and process this information. And basically, what the animal self eventually evolved into, especially along our lineage, was thinking and feeling. So all the thoughts and feelings that we have, the emotions that we experience, even our base level consciousness, all of this comes from this function of the animal self, which is really trying to make a map of reality, taking in information, organizing it together in terms of perception, and then using that map to make predictions about what would happen next. And this is what would help that organism thrive. The other amazing thing about the animal self and the multicellular animal self is that not only was it doing this, coordinating all of these cells together in terms of itself, but then animals really started working together and jointly. And so we see the rise of interdependence, not just intradependence within cells, but interdependence across animals themselves. And that would be the story of life up until about 100,000 years ago. If you look at almost every other life form that's out there, they are just in their animal self. And the way they are finding and resisting entropy and finding order and keeping themselves ordered in the face of entropy and the degradation of entropy is just something that's honed through evolution. They've evolved a genetic structure that creates a lot of tissues and behaviors. And from that, that's what they're constrained by. Their whole sense of self is something that has evolved and is always constrained and being pruned by their local ecology. But about 100,000 years ago, there was one species that started doing something different, and they totally changed the ways that they were resisting entropy and finding new ways of ordering themselves. And these were, of course, human beings, and the way they were doing this was through language. It was really about 100,000 years ago that our ancestors first started speaking. They started making laws. They started making rules. And more importantly, they started reflecting on themselves as an object of inquiry. And what the linguistic self does, it allows us to have culture and technology, and it allows us to begin to regulate our own behavior. And it actually regulates our own behavior oftentimes in opposition to this animal self. And so we had this other layer of self that emerged from culture and language and kind of shared cooperative activities with one another. But it oftentimes put us at wars with ourselves. And I think this is, if you look in the wisdom traditions or the philosophical traditions or even the psychological traditions, you see this theme coming up again and again and again. Like, you know, there was a Garden of Eden where we were sort of in our natural selves, and then we fall out of that natural self. And the reason we fall out of that natural self is because language introduces this kind of synthetic component to us. We begin to start fabricating our own order. And that's, on one hand, it's been great. Like, we are at the top of the food chain. Nobody really tries to eat us anymore. We've produced longer, healthier, more secure lives as a species than at any time in our history. At the same time, though, it's also dislodged us from our more authentic way of being. And this is where we begin to see our self-processes begin to fall out of alignment. And when I say fall out of alignment, the way to understand what yourself is trying to do is that any energy system has to do two things. It has to order itself. It has to keep itself structured and keep itself coherent. But it also, of course, has to keep its energy going. And I call these two things order and vitality. So imagine, like, for example, if you've got a fire. Order is like would be the fire crew for the fire. They would, you know, tend the fire, put more fuel on, keep it burning at just the right level. And then vitality is the intensity and the heat and the brightness of the fire itself. And for every living creature that's out there that's an energy system resisting entropy, what it's got to do is find the optimal level between order and vitality. What is the appropriate kind of homeostatic balance that they could find to burn their energy most efficiently and just right for their ecology? And that's basically been the story up until recently. Once we have a linguistic self, once we have culture on top of that, it really begins to distort those balances. And one of the thinkers who really brought this to our attention was Sigmund Freud. And he basically said, this is the cost of civilization to us. Civilization takes us out of our animal self, demands us to repress our animal selves, and it does this at the cost of this imbalance. And what he saw the cost of this imbalance is in our neuroses. Basically, we are subject to an enormous amount of emotional experiences that are inappropriate to the moment at hand. So think about all our own anxieties and feelings of guilt or depression or despondencies or resentments. Typically, these are emotional responses that are inappropriate to whatever moment we're living in. That's the challenge of the linguistic self. And the problem is it just doesn't stop there, because not only do we have a linguistic self, but if you go to the next layer of the Russian nesting doll, you'll have what I would call the egoistic self. Now, if the linguistic self is binding us together in a shared community of language, symbols, stories, and myths, and rules, and laws, and all of technology and culture and everything, the egoistic self is what's there, part of our self-processes that's negotiating for us as an individual with respect to other people. And whereas the linguistic self wants to kind of label and judge and order the world, what the egoistic self craves is status and recognition and love. We want to feel good, and we want to feel good about ourselves. And this is the function of our egoistic self. It's basically there to make us feel better about our own existence and to do that vis-a-vis other people. We want other people to respect us, to admire us, to love us. And the egoistic self is that all of those processes that cohere together that try to make that happen for us. And they usually get encapsulated within our identities, our feelings of ourselves, and most importantly, in the stories that we tell. The way the ego often reveals itself to us is through our stories. They're the stories of each moment, of our successes and failures throughout the day. They're the stories of our lives that kind of pull all of these individual experiences together. And then they're the greater narratives that we have about life and our whole cosmology that give our lives purpose and meaning. And it's through all of these stories and narratives that this other layer of the self really expresses itself. Now, here's the thing. We typically identify, I think, most heavily with our egoistic self. It probably dominates our ordinary consciousness most of the time. When we are thinking and negotiating with the world, we're typically doing it through a bunch of egoistic markers. You know, how is that person making me feel? What rights should I expect to have? What privileges should I expect to have? Am I good enough for this? You know, how dare they do that to me? You know, all of these different kinds of narratives are really driven by this egoistic self. And once again, you can see where this causes imbalance for us, because we spend so much energy and so much time trying to feel good about ourselves, trying to placate this egoistic self, often in ways that are really, really inefficient for us. And then this actually then leads us to what I would say is the outer layer of ourself. And this comes from most spiritual traditions, most wisdom traditions, I think even in contemporary positive psychology. And this is what I would call the transcendent self. And what the transcendent self is there to do is to try to find balance at all of these other layers of the self. It's trying to reestablish an appropriate balance between order and vitality, and particularly to try to better reconcile our egoistic selves and our linguistic selves with our animal selves. And that's a tall order. And the part of the challenge is that we tend to, I think, overly denigrate our animal self or misunderstand our animal self. We oftentimes embrace through no fault of our own, but we're brought up, for example, in cultural traditions that, you know, demand a lot of us, demand a lot of self-abnegation, for example, or cause us to repress many parts of our animalistic being. Or we might have been brought up in individual experiences that gives us some really distorted ego processes. So maybe we become overly ego-centered, or we become self-abnegating. We don't think we're worthy of somebody else's love, or we don't actually know how to engage someone to get the kind of love that we need. And what the transcendent self is there to do is the part of us that's trying to then fix and reconcile all of these other layers so that we can live in a more efficient and optimal way. And when I say by efficient and optimal way, what I mean is we actually are beings of energy. We are luminescence. We actually have this incredible effervescence that tingles beneath the surface of our ordinary consciousness. And, you know, when you have those extraordinary experiences in life, when you're out there in nature, for example, on top of the mountain, when you're dancing with friends, you know, at a wedding, for example, when you're having those peak experiences, that's when oftentimes we tap into this glorious effervescence that tingles beneath us. And that's really our birthright. And most of the time, that is not really available to our ordinary consciousness because these other layers of the self are so dominating our attention and so distracting us and absorbing so many energies from us to keep themselves going that we're really cut off to what is a much more sublime and beautiful way of being that has a potential for us that lurks beneath this. And if you look at all the various wisdom traditions, the contemplative traditions, the psychological traditions about thriving, they're really about how do you access this greater level of just effervescent bloom. And the way you do it is by kind of disentangling and disassembling all these layers of self that have calcified and keep you moving in inappropriate directions. A big task of knowing yourself, I think this is really what knowing yourself is ultimately about. It's about trying to find this transcendent self and trying to find these transcendent practices that can allow this to happen. And one of the things that I hope with this project is by describing these layers of self is to make these processes more legible and to try to integrate these various traditions and ways of knowledge that I think exist apart from each other. So say, for example, neuroscience and psychology and philosophy and the Eastern contemplative traditions and bring them together. And this is what this description of the self is trying to do. And this is what the book project is trying to do. And in a lot of ways, this is what this podcast is about doing. By talking to various people, it's pulling out each of these elements, but in the whole, what I'm trying to do is synthesize them into this understanding of what these self processes are and how we can make them work better. So if you are intrigued by this, I have started a YouTube channel where I'm basically promoting the lectures from my course. And so I give weekly lectures on this, on these various dimensions of the self and how they're malfunctioning and how they can work better. So if you go on to 9 questions with Eric Oliver on YouTube, or you just type in how to know yourself, Eric Oliver on YouTube, you can begin to find some of these lectures. And so I encourage you, if you liked what I was just describing here and you want to hear more about it, go on the YouTube channel. You'll see the lectures that are there. Hopefully they can be helpful for you and illuminating. And in the meantime, thanks so much for listening to the podcast. I've really appreciated doing this project. I really appreciate having a listenership, and I hope you've found it entertaining and informative and maybe even enlightening.
If you're enjoying the discussions we're having on this program, here's another University of Chicago Podcast Network show you should check out. It's called The Pie. Economists are always talking about The Pie, how it grows and shrinks, how it's sliced, and who gets the biggest share. Join host Tess Figland as she talks with leading economists about their cutting-edge research and key events of the day. Hear how the economic pie is at the heart of issues like the aftermath of a global pandemic, jobs, energy policy, and much more.